This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome, welcome. I'm Alex. Are you ready for the bad news about climate change? Really? I'm going to play you a speech too awful to run during the holidays. People with clinical depression and very young children may want to avoid this program. It's also going to be a challenge for our many North American listeners because our speaker is Kevin Anderson. From his recent post as director of the Tyndall Center, the UK's top academic institute researching climate change, Anderson speaks quickly, he says a lot, and he holds nothing back. This lecture is part of the London School of Economics Department of International Development Friday lecture series. The title is Beyond Dangerous Climate Change, Emission Scenarios for a New World. Anderson calls it The Brutal Logic of Climate Change. This talk set up a blaze of urgency and a stiff warning to people and governments. We are failing to address the greatest challenge ever faced by humanity. Something unimaginable is happening. Following this edited for radio speech, I'll chat again with Professor Bill Calvin from the University of Washington. He sees the bleakness, but he offers us a grain of hope. I'm going to throw you into the deep end with this one. Here's Dr. Kevin Anderson, recorded October 21st, 2011, in Hong Kong Theatre, Clement House, London.
I've called this talk Climate Change Going Beyond Dangerous. I've made the assumption that quite a lot of you are not working on a day-to-day basis on climate change. And the subtitle of this is Brutal Numbers and Tenuous Hope. Brutal numbers comes back to the economics of genocide, I think. Brutal numbers, because what the numbers I'm going to use today as an engineer, as a scientist involved in climate change, they're not attractive. They're just numbers, though. I mean, they come, they're neutral. They're just the numbers that we have. The implications of them are absolutely dire. And I do not believe in any way in trying to spin things to make them attractive or unattractive. I don't want friends. I don't want to make enemies. I just want to say the results of our analysis as they come out, as clearly and unambiguously as possible. And the results of this work, and you can see that in the papers that myself and my colleagues have published, the most recent one in the Royal Society's Philosophical Transactions in January, paint a very bleak future. There are lots of people out there spinning this into lovely optimistic futures of green growth and nonsense like that. But in reality, this is not the future we're heading towards at the moment. And tenuous hope, brutal numbers and tenuous hope, the thread of hope is getting thinner day by day. And I'll come back to that as we go through. The science makes that really quite clear, that every day we fail on climate change, and every day we do fail on climate change, do anything about it, the situation gets worse for the following day. And this is the other approach, think of cognitive dissonance, a fancy Hippocratic term, academic term for hypocrisy, for putting your head in the sand. And that's pretty much what we've done, particularly in the Annex 1, the wealthy parts of the world, the OECD countries, for the last 20 years or so. The first Rio summit was in 1992, and since then emissions have done nothing but grow. So we've done absolutely nothing on climate change of any significance at all, other than fly around the world to conferences about it. This is not a story of positive messages, but I will give some messages of hope towards the end, some things that I think that we could be doing, but we're choosing not to do. So I want to explore the void between the rhetoric on climate change, what we say we're doing globally, collectively, as individuals, and the reality of actually what's there when you measure it, what does appear to be happening. So a lot of people say, I work on climate change, a lot of industry people, a lot of academics, and they say, well, what do you mean by climate change? And they sort of ramble on about they're trying to improve the performance of a car engine or a jet engine or some other angel on the head of a pin type activity that has very little to do with climate change. So I think it's not unreasonable, before we start to think about the issue, what's the question that we're trying to answer? As an academic, it's not an unreasonable thing to go back to your aims and your objectives. Now, I may not agree with these, but these are the ones that have been set us, I think, from the international level. This is the Copenhagen Accord, which, although the Copenhagen Summit in December 2009, was a bit of a damp squib, it did have some benefits in that what came out of it was a very clear and simple statement. At last, the lawyers didn't get to this principally, that's why you can read it, that globally we should be staying below 2 degrees temperature rise, and on the basis of science, and on the basis of equity. Now this is a really radical statement. I'm amazed that American lawyers didn't pick this up. Although this was a voluntary agreement, if you like, the Copenhagen Agreement that came after this, a lot of countries are now signed up to this, so the UK being one of them. So we are signed up to keep the temperatures below a 2 degrees C rise, compared to what it was before we started burning fossil fuels at the start of the Industrial Revolution. But the UK and the EU have similar sorts of targets. The EU regularly has these sorts of statements about must stay less than 2 degrees C. Notice it's always must stay less or something below 2 degrees C, at or below. It's not a 50-50 chance of 2 degrees C or a 70% chance of exceeding 2 degrees C. It's not that sort of language, despite the fact when you look at the policies in detail, that's what comes out. The UK in the Low Carbon Transition Plan must rise no more than 2 degrees centigrade. So the question is really clear. How do we set about putting in mitigation, reductions in emissions, that can be reconciled with keeping below 2 degrees centigrade rise? But why 2 degrees C? Where did this number come from? 2 degrees C rise in temperature is the threshold between acceptable climate change that we think we can deal with, may not want it, but overall it's dealable with on a global level, and dangerous climate change, above which we think, well, that's, it gets pretty damaging, and in fact, we really should avoid that. Above that, the impacts are too severe to contemplate, so we must stay below it. But that's, if you notice, 2001, and this has all been cast looking at some of the more recent science. This is from 2009, Smith and another paper by Mann, 2009. And what you basically notice, and this is more red, and the more red basically tells you the impacts occur, greater impacts occur at those temperatures equivalent to before. And if you put 2 degrees C on here, you get a lot more impacts than you thought you would have got before. Now, if the raison d'etre, if your logic is that you must avoid these impacts here, above that level there, where do they lie on this one? So if 2 degrees C was said to be the threshold between acceptable and dangerous impacts, surely now 2 degrees C is the threshold between dangerous and extremely dangerous impacts. And language, as Wittgenstein and many others have pointed out, is hugely important in how we see the issue. So we should no longer use 2 degrees C as this threshold between acceptable and dangerous. It's between dangerous and extremely dangerous if you want to follow the logic. Is 1 degree C the new 2 degrees C? Should we be aiming for 1 degree C? Well, we're a bit stuck there because we're pretty much at 1 degree C now. But I think that does change the colour of the problem that we're looking at. Now, I'm going to stick with 2. I'm going to stick with 2 because it's embedded in a lot of legislation. I'm staying agnostic about whether it's an appropriate target or not for today. But I'm going to stick with 2 degrees centigrade. And anyway, 1 degree is pretty much out of the picture now, unless you had some way of sucking the CO2 out of the air. So I'm going to look at 2 degrees C for mitigation. So emission reduction targets, these are probably things you're familiar with. I hope you're familiar with them to some extent. 80% reduction by 2050, a large reduction by not in my term of office. So this is the sort of thing as politicians we all like, because technology will solve the problem in 2030 or 2040. It's a big reduction by some point way out in the future. I'll be retired or dead by then. And we like it as individuals, because we can carry on flying around the world and having our nice, exotic, high-carbon lifestyles, and we can leave it to our children to sort out and a few technologists. So we all like this. But the CO2 stays in the atmosphere for 100, 200 years. So this talk tonight may have no impact on any of you in relation to climate change, but it will affect the climate for the next 200 years. This projector being on, the lights being on in here, and this will all affect the climate as the coal pumps into the atmosphere, the coal is burnt and the CO2 goes into the atmosphere and will affect the climate for the next few hundred years. So this lecture is having an impact one way or another. So the 2050 targets, these long-term targets, are actually meaningless because we're not worried about what happens in 2050. We can have an international agreement to just before midnight in 2049 to just not do anything for 1 second. And there you are, you've met your 2050 target. But you've done nothing about climate change. What matters for climate change, and the only thing that matters really significantly for the long-lived greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and quite a lot of the other synthetic gases, are cumulative emissions, the emissions that build up day in, day out in the atmosphere. That's what matters. That's what correlates with temperature, even more than concentration. So it's not about long-term, meaningless, scientifically illiterate targets, despite the fact lots of scientists keep using them. It's about the cumulative emissions that build up in the atmosphere, and that completely changes the story of climate change in a direction none of us like. So you start to see reasons to why it is that we don't often talk about cumulative emissions, because it changes the whole chronology, the whole time frame of climate change. From long-term gradual reductions where our kids and a few technologists will solve it in the future to, oh dear, we need to do something this afternoon. Yeah, urgent and radical reductions. Complete shift of the time frame of climate change, if you take the science into account. Now, how does this scientifically credible approach change the whole challenge that we face, moving us away from sort of 2050 reductions, large 80% reduction by 2050, the sort of language we normally hear? Well, first, let's think about what we're factoring in. What are the latest emission trends? This is a curve you're all familiar with. Everything about humans is like this. Plasma screen ownership. Remember football matches we go and see, how much we pay footballers, how many academics we train, how many TVs we own, how many flights we take. Everything a human being is pretty much exponential. Population as well at the moment. So, yeah, and we're the only species that seems to be pursuing this, because anyone else, any other species, would have either died out or would be in the process of dying out. But we're sufficiently arrogant to think that we can overcome this, that we can be exponential in everything, and somehow we'll resolve this problem. Well, you know, a bit of humility might suggest that this is a genetic cul-de-sac. You cannot carry on doing this. Remember, 1992 was the Earth Summit in Rio. So we've talked about climate change a lot since then. So you think, well, the emissions must be going down, because we've been really concerned about this climate change issue. We had Rio, we've had numerous conferences. It's in the news regularly, climate change. But the growth rate went up. After 2000, the growth rate has gone up to 3.5% per annum. And remember, it's going up from a larger number. So it's a bigger percentage of a larger number, year on year on year, which is why it's exponential. More recently, the bankers and a few other financiers have come on board and felt climate change is a serious issue and collapsed the world, well, at least the Western economies. And that's been quite beneficial from a climate change perspective. I don't think they were doing it deliberately, but it's about the only time you see emissions come down is when something happens to the economy. So the latest number we have is a growth rate of almost 6%, 5 to 6% per annum, on a larger number, year on year. And we're supposed to be reducing our emissions dramatically. And the emissions are going up at an exponential rate, or an exponential curve, and the rate is increasing. Now, that might be a blip after the economic downturn. It may not be. But it certainly suggests that the trends in 2000 are in the 3 to 5% mark. And there's no suggestion they're going to come down, if you think about it. So if we combine this failure, I think abject failure would be more appropriate, with the science on cumulative emissions, what does that say about this 2 degrees pathway that we've all merrily signed up to? These next graphs are based on a paper myself and some colleagues, one colleague, I suppose, published in 2008 in the Royal Society Journal. And what's important here is that the earlier you peak emissions, this is broadly right, the earlier you peak emissions reach a maximum and then start to come down, the lower the rate of reduction is after that peak. Remember, you've got a set budget. You've only got a certain amount of money you can spend or carbon you can squander. So the sooner you can stop squandering your carbon quicker, the slower will be the downturn after that on that curve. And that's quite important.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are listening to one of Britain's top climate scientists, Kevin Anderson, in his speech, Beyond Dangerous Climate Change, Emission Scenarios for a New World.
You also notice it doesn't go down to zero, and that's because unless you have compulsory euthanasia, you're going to have some people living on the planet. If people live on the planet, they'll eat food. If they eat food, you'll have carbon emissions in the form of N2O and methane. So you cannot get away from the fact that if people want to eat, you'll get emissions. There's nothing you can do about that. If you plough the soil, you'll release methane into the atmosphere. So food will give you emissions, and there's nothing we can do to get that down to zero, as far as we're aware. You may be able to reduce it. At the moment, it's going up significantly. So if you've got a population going out into the future, every bit of emissions that comes into agriculture there stops you using, say, energy or some other part there. If you go to 2020, notice it gets steeper and steeper because you've got the same budget. So the later you leave the peak, the faster you come down off it. But you also notice there's less lines. By 2025, there's a lot less lines. And that's because by then, quite a lot of the science models say you've already blown your budget. So only the more optimistic end of the science is it now viable. So here, you notice it's like lemmings off a cliff. It's pretty much vertical. And this is for something like a 50-50 chance of 2 degrees C. So a 50-50 chance of extremely dangerous climate change, if we could do those sorts of reduction rates. Now let's look at 2020, which is 5 years after Stern says it's viable. The Committee on Climate Change, the UK's semi-independent committee that advises the government on climate change, uses in its report 2016 as a peak. You can go and decide whether you think that's viable. 2020, I would suggest, is pushing it about as hard as you could possibly imagine pushing it. And there's no indication at the moment 2020 will be doable, but let's imagine we could. We peak in 2020, we have to come off the curve at about 10% per annum. 10% every single year in our emissions reductions. Every single year. Now, if you start to split that across the poorer and the richer parts of the world, that could be higher for the richer parts of the world. Let's strip out deforestation from this, and let's strip out food emissions from it, and that's what's left for energy, which is the area I spend most of my time working on. Now, I'm being really optimistic about us cutting back on deforestation here, and I'm being really optimistic about what we do in terms of our food emissions. So we're not being negative, we're being quite positive about what could be achieved. We've taken those emissions out, and then you say, well, what's left? Well, firstly, most of the science says you've got nothing left. By 2011, by the time you've taken that deforestation out into the future, and food emissions for a population of, say, 9 billion by 2050, We've done that, 13 of the 18 scenarios on coming out of the science are no longer viable. You've blown the budget. So you've got to be really optimistic on the science. And then when you do plot it, you find you can have no emissions in the atmosphere by 2035 to 2045. So if you're really optimistic on the science, you've only got till 2035 to 45 to have no emissions out of your energy system. That's not things like carbon capture and storage, because carbon capture and storage will have quite a lot of emissions still going into the atmosphere from coal. So there's a whole lot of the technologies people talk about are nowhere near zero. Not even approaching it. Now, those technologies simply wouldn't fit into this sort of world. This is basically zero carbon. Your planes, your ships, your cars, your power systems, everything. So that's looking a little challenging. And that's giving you only really a very outside chance of 2 degrees C. And look at the reduction rate, 10 to 20% every single year. Now that may or may not mean anything to you, 10 to 20%. So let's have a think about it. What precedents do we have for this? Well, Stern made note in his report that 1% reduction in emissions has only ever been associated with economic recession or upheaval. We've seen that more recently, so maybe we see these sort of reductions. In fact, the economic downturn saw a reduction of about 1.3% of emissions. So we have no real precedence for this. But the UK had a massive dash for gas, a big shift to gas-fired power stations, which are a lot more efficient than coal-fired power stations. The French had a 40-fold increase in nuclear power, massive increase in about 20 years. So big shifts in both those countries to low-carbon electricity sources. They weren't done for carbon reasons, but they were done for other reasons. But huge transitions to low-carbon energy systems, or lower carbon. And yet they only had a 1% reduction in emissions in those countries. And that's because they grew. And if you factor in aviation and shipping, which is not included in most of the inventories around, not in the inventories around the world, it's in a memo that's attached, because somehow that I think God deals with emissions from planes and ships, then there's no reduction in emissions from the best example we have historically of a move to a low-carbon energy system. And I'm not recommending this, as some people suggested before. They said I must be a communist because I'm putting this up. Now, the collapse of the Soviet economy did achieve, if you call it achieve, 5% reduction in emissions year on year for about 10 years. So the collapse of the Soviet economy achieved somewhere between a half and a quarter of what we would need to do. And that was by collapsing their economy, which perhaps we've been trying that more recently. Why is it different from the stuff that we normally hear in the news? Why is this a different analysis? We're using all the same science. The analysis I use is all the stuff from the Hadley Centre and all the main scientific bodies. The first thing is the growth rate to the peak. That's hugely important. How fast are emissions growing to the peak? Virtually every single scenario out there has emissions growing at 1 to 2% per annum, despite the fact that hasn't occurred for over a decade. You think, well, let's go back and look at the data and see if we should change it. The problem is if you change it, your policymakers don't like the results. So 1 to 2% per annum, that's what the Committee on Climate Change have assumed for global emission increase. Well, it hasn't been that since probably back in the 90s, probably the early 90s. So what on earth are we doing having such low numbers? Real numbers are probably nearer 3 or 4% per annum. The peak years, virtually every analysis out there, all the low carbon scenarios out there, have emissions peaking somewhere between 2010 and 2015 or 16. And quite a lot of them have been peaking in the past. Now, I'm an engineer and I think we can do quite a lot with engineering, but travelling back in time is one that we're still struggling with. So I don't know why it is that quite major reports are having reductions, that are having peaks in the past. And I can point to some of those very serious reports. Then the Committee on Climate Change has its peak in 2016, but that infers that that would require China and India to peak in 2017. Now, Richard spent some time in China, and no one in China thought that was viable, and no one in China had been spoken to by the British about how come could you please peak in 2017 to help us. The rate of emission reductions coming off the top of the curve is an order of magnitude higher than what the economists want. So the economists say 3% or 4% is doable per year, and we're going into the 10s and 20%, so it's an order of magnitude different. Technology, everyone has a great hope for technology. I spent my time, I left home at 16 and worked on large ships around the world, talking about the ship world on ships, training as a marine engineer. I later worked on the oil companies in the North Sea, designing and then building oil rigs and producing oil. And so I think technology can do a lot. We were drilling 40 miles away from the rig under the seabed, up to 7 kilometres deep. So, really quite impressive bits of kit. I still don't think we can do anywhere near what people are saying out there. Lots of academics, scientists in particular, but also a lot of other policymakers think we can do these amazing, almost magical things with technology. William Hague said some time ago that engineers were able to get jet engines to 100% efficiency. This is a non-marginal world. These are not small changes. Market economics, neoclassical economics, your Chicago's, your Austrians, all those schools are pretty much, all of them premised on marginal changes. Small adjustments in what it is that you're looking at. We're not talking about small adjustments here, we're talking about step changes. The theoretical framing for most economics says nothing about step changes. It's like using Newtonian mechanics to understand quantum mechanics. They're theoretically inappropriate. So we should not be using these inappropriate methods and tools to deal with a problem that is non-marginal. That's not to say that economics, market economics, has a place to play in particular niches, but as the major guiding influence for what we should be doing, it is completely and fundamentally flawed. So 2 degrees C looks almost impossible, and that would be always impossible, we can't do 2 degrees C. So let's think of a higher temperature then. Well, what about 4 degrees C? How about 4? Can we do 4? Well, if we peak emissions in 2020 and then come down off the curve at about 3.5% per annum, which will keep the economists happy, then we can get to 4. We can have the cumulative budget in the atmosphere, the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, that roughly relates to 4 degrees C or there or thereabouts. So 4 degrees C is doable. We can get there. But would we want to be there? A 4°C global mean surface temperature. Remember that? Remember the means are what's really dangerous in this stuff. People think, oh, 4°C. Well, if you live in Manchester, 4°C sounds quite pleasant. But so 4°C warming. Remember, most of the ocean, most of the planet is covered in sea. And the oceans, the water, has a very high thermal mass. So it takes a lot longer for it to warm up. So a 4°C global mean temperature could well be sort of 5 or 6 on land. You'll see a higher temperature on average on land. And there's a quite nice interactive model you can play with from the Hadley Centre and some other people that have fed into that. And if you look at what 4°C would mean as an increase in temperature on the hottest days, then for India and for China, you're talking about 6 to 8 degrees additional warming. So imagine the hot days in China and then put 6 to 8 degrees of warming on that. Could people cope during the hot periods in these countries? Could you go to Central Europe or even London and put 8 to 10 degrees on the heat wave we had here in 2003? You can't cool the tube. You know, no one would be going to work. We've chopped down, well, at least we've chopped down most of our trees. So there's no transevaporation anyway. Probably the diet, those temperatures. In New York, 10 to 12 degrees. That's the additional warming you would get on the hottest periods of the year. But more worryingly, from a development point of view, at low latitudes, you'd see a 40% reduction in some of the staple crops. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty around this stuff. Let's not pretend these numbers are precise. They're accurate, but not precise. We don't know. We can't go and look somewhere else to try and find these things. And all of that occurs at the same time the population heads towards 9 billion by 2050. 4°C doesn't look particularly pleasant. And from polling scientists, which I do quite regularly, whenever I go to meetings, I ask them about these sort of things. And the impression I've been left with quite clearly, and Brian Hoskins, the major climate scientist on the Committee for Climate Change, would I think, endorse this, that 4°C is incompatible with an organised global community, if that's what we have today. It's likely beyond what we would normally think of as adaptation, something that was done in an organised fashion, not just chaos as we all reach for a Kalashnikov. Most ecosystems probably are not going to survive that. We get new ecosystems, but the ones we have, ecosystems evolve and change all the time. But they don't normally change this rapidly. This is like a meteorite hitting the Earth. We've got new ecosystems after that, but is that what we want to be? Is that what we want our behaviours to be, a meteorite hitting the Earth? And the more worryingly, 4°C, 75% of scientists I talk to say it's unlikely that you would hold at 4°C. If you got to 4, the feedback mechanisms that are there, some people call them tipping points, but discontinuities and so forth in the system, means the temperature would keep going up, 4, 5, 6, 7, and it would stabilise at some new temperature much higher. So 4°C looks like it would be an interim temperature that you would go through. And some of the modelling from the Hadley Centre, the ones with the higher carbon cycle feedbacks, say this could be as early as 2050, 2060, this temperature, 4°C. The International Energy Agency had 2035, but I can't find out where they got that from. But I think what you can conclude from this is that we should avoid 4°C at all costs, literally at all costs, and we should not go there. You then start thinking, well, what does that mean, and what do we have to do for 2°C? Well, it gets worse, certainly for us in wealthy countries, or the wealthy people around the world, not just the wealthy ones in the wealthy countries. Let's now split the emissions between the non-OECD and the OECD. This is a paper that we published in January of this year. What we asked here, a lot of people talk about apportionment. How do you apportion emissions between poor people and rich people and so forth? Well, to be honest, when you get to this late in the day, it's to forget your apportionment regimes. You're not bothered about fairness. You're just worried about practicality. So we've lost the opportunity to think about it in a nice, neat way, despite the fact lots of people are still doing that. So we said, well, what could we imagine the non-Annex 1 countries doing? The absolute most, if they were really persuaded it was a good idea, or they persuaded themselves that it was a good idea, what could they do? If they grew at 3.5% per annum, which is way less than they're growing today, so if they could grow much, much lower emissions than they're growing now, if they could peak by 2025, I didn't find anyone in China, bar one person who works in energy and climate change, that thinks that's viable. Was everyone else maybe 2030, if not later? If they could come down off the curve at 7% per annum, twice that the Stern says is possible with economic growth. So this is a bit challenging. Even the Americans would say, well, we are pushing the non-Annex 1 countries here. And then you say, what's left for us? There's nothing left. You've used up the budget there, so there's nothing left for us. So it starts to say, well, what do you think about this? This is much more challenging than we're normally told. Part of the reason it's more challenging is, remember, the Committee on Climate Change and many of the good people working on integrated assessment models have the peak for these countries way down here in about 2017. So when you put a bit of reality, a bit of context into this, you get a completely different story. Just to think about China's emissions. China currently have about a quarter, 25% of the world's CO2 emissions, about 7.5 billion tonnes, that is. Their growth rate has been 10.5% per annum, GDP growth rate, for a long time, well over a decade. And economists told us right back in the 90s that couldn't carry on. Well, it's carrying on at the moment. Economists tell us now it can't carry on. Well, maybe they're right. Eventually they will be. But, very high growth rates. India, same emissions as Japan, 6% global emissions and growing at 7.5% per annum. And I've no idea how their economy is doing at 7.5%. It looks much more unstructured and chaotic than the Chinese one. But both these economies are doing phenomenally well in terms of growth rates, faster growth rates than occurred during much of the Industrial Revolution. So we don't have many historical precedents for this rate of GDP growth. Can this continue? Well, Beijing and Shanghai have roughly the same GDP per capita as the OECD average, roughly for Beijing and Shanghai. Beijing and Shanghai collectively have about two-thirds of the UK's population. So they're big cities, they're much bigger than the cities here. So about two-thirds of the UK's population live in two cities in China. There are 200 million Chinese that earn less than $1.25 a day. These are market exchange rate numbers. I'm sorry I couldn't find the PPP numbers. So 200 million, that's about half the population of the EU. There are 350 million Chinese on $10 to $20 a day. The reason I'm putting these numbers up there is to say there's massive scope for growth of mean income in China before the costs of their productivity start going up and we cannot buy so much of their stuff. So there's huge scope for low-wage industrialisation still. There's no reason, I can envisage, the why this should dramatically change the pathway that we've seen. This is often the argument, oh, well, they all want to start getting paid like we are. Well, there's a hell of a lot of people there not getting paid anywhere near it. And that's before you even put India on there, and then maybe possibly even Africa. If China follows its five-year plan, and it's very good at following its five-year plan, its 12th five-year plan, then its emissions in 2020 will be about half of the total global emissions of CO2 now. And there's almost no reason to think it will do anything other than that. So by 2020, when emissions will be rocketing off the curve, really, China will represent 50% of global emissions compared with today. I mean, it would be much more if everyone else gets their emissions down. Now, I'm not trying to blame the Chinese in the slightest. About a third of their emissions relate to what they flog to us, like my laptop, for instance. Now, if they carry on to 2030, their emissions in 2030 would be the same as the world today. Now, by 2030, a lot of other things could have changed. Are these numbers reasonable? Well, the Chinese energy and climate change community I spoke to said, yes, they thought they were reasonable. They thought emissions would peak in 2030 in China and then plateau, not come down. The minimum growth rate to peak, they thought, would be 7%. One person said it could be as low as 5%. Remember, I'm assuming 3.5% here. The maximum post-peak reduction was 3.5% to 5%, in keeping with the economists. Are these absolute numbers reasonable? Well, the Chinese seem to think so. But I couldn't find any Western models out there, so let's assume the Western modellers and the scenario builders imply that they're not. Look at the Western models that we build. We don't take care of China at all. We almost don't think it exists. Or India. Emissions in 2020 are very likely to be somewhere about two-thirds of the total global emissions at the moment for India and China. And just those two countries. They're going to peak somewhere about 2030. Maybe it come earlier, but not much earlier. The Indians think much later than that. And they represent, I think it's about 35% of the global figure, population figure by 2020. That could be. This doesn't look too unreasonable from an Indian-Chinese perspective. It doesn't fit at all with our analysis over here on climate change. Does all this matter? Well, I would say that our scenarios have taken almost no account of India and China, and repeatedly take no account of India and China. My first impressions are that these numbers are a game changer. They fundamentally change what it is we need to think about in terms of climate change. So this 2°C number we keep hearing about, it seems like it's like a creed, it's something we can't question. And that does appear to be the case to me, I work on this number all the time, and almost every day I think about 2°C as I'm walking to work. This is from the Avoid Project, a statement from there, I think it was 2009, given during the Copenhagen meeting in Denmark. It's possible to restrict warming to 2°C or less with a 50% probability. Where do they think they're coming from when they sort of say these things? This is the Committee on Climate Change. For 2°C, the UK needs to cut emissions by 80% by 2050. The good news is that reductions of that side are possible without sacrificing the benefits of economic growth and rising prosperity. Well, maybe if your name's Harry Potter, but I think the rest of us would struggle to see how you can reconcile these. I cannot see how you can come up with statements like that and justify them against the context of the world that we live in. And remember, this is policy guidance, and I have a huge amount of respect for the CCC. There's no other organisation like that globally that's advising government. We have cumulative budgets in the UK, not just endpoint targets. We're way ahead in setting the rhetorical umbrella, if you like, for climate change. So all credit to them. But statements like that, I think, are hugely misleading. This is the ADAM project. A low stabilisation of 400 ppmv CO2e, that's lower than we are today, can be achieved at moderate cost with a high likelihood of achieving this goal. I mean, this is a different world from the one I live in. I just don't understand it. And I've discussed it a lot with these people. We use the same science.
This is Radio EcoShock with the UK's Kevin Anderson on the brutal logic of climate change. We'll be right back.